Something happened on the day he died. Spirit rose a meter and stepped aside. Somebody else took his place and bravely cried. I'm a black star. I'm a black star.
Fans of David Bowie around the world have paid tribute to the rock star, who has died at the age of 69. A remarkable array of musicians, artists and leaders have spoken of their admiration for a musician whose career spanned...
Hello and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed, and I hope you are safe and well, wherever and indeed whenever you are. So, in this episode, welcome to the first in a three-part series where we're going to be looking at the final album, Black Star, from 2016. If you're anything like me, this album is holding a very, very special place in your heart. To be honest, for me, it's an album that is quite hard to listen to. A lot of the time, it's very emotional. I remember, obviously, getting it the day it came out. I went to the launch party, a launch party, I should say, for it in Berlin at the Hansa Studios, of course, where else? And it was such a mind-blowing album to encounter for the first time. It was one of those rare moments where you get an album and you eagerly stick it on and you start listening to it and you're just transported immediately, and you don't know quite what's going on, but you know it's really good and that there's going to be lots here that is going to be worth investigating. That's how I felt when I first heard Black Star. 3 days later, I was devastated and I thought, this album has it all. This album is basically a farewell note. So as you can imagine, if you felt the same way, it's going to be very hard to listen to. That said, coming back to it in preparation for this podcast recording, I was amazed at just how fun it is. It's really, aside from the somber tone, an album where you can hear musicians, artists collaborating, sparking off each other. Everyone, Bowie, Visconti, Donny McCaslin, his band, everyone involved in this sounds like they're having a whale of a time, which sounds a funny thing to say when you think about Black Star, but it's true. And if you saw the last 5 years, the wonderful documentary, I think it's fairly evident that the people involved in the making of Black Star are unanimous that this was a creative highlight of their careers. So without too much further ado, I'm going to introduce you now to Donny McCaslin, who very, very kindly gave up a few hours of his time over the last few weeks to talk me through Black Star. And also I had on board Leah Cardos, who is the project manager of the Tony Visconti Studios in South London. And she's also writing a book about Bowie's final years, and she's a musician in her own right. So I really wanted her along because I wanted her take on Black Star and on Donny's work from the point of view of a fellow musician. I felt this would really bring a lot to the podcast. And lo and behold, so it did. I'm very glad that Leah joined us because, as you will hear, her contribution really makes this podcast something special. So with my two fantastic guests, Leah Cardos and Donny McCaslin, here we go. This is the first installment. We're not even really getting to a song by song run through of the album just yet. This first episode is really the background to Black Star, how everyone got in place, how it all came together. In the next episode, we'll start with the actual title track and then we'll work on from there, because as you can imagine, that takes up a lot of time. So this episode is just the curtain raiser on what I hope will be a series you will really enjoy and enjoy listen to as much as I enjoyed making. So here we go. A lot of people listening to this podcast are familiar with Donny and know who he is, and we'll be talking a lot to him about his work on Black Star. But Leah, could you just introduce yourself a little bit and tell us a little about who you are and what you do, because you've got a couple of incredibly cool connections to the world of Bowie.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm just a super fan at the bottom level. But yeah, I'm also a music scholar and a musician. And I have the Visconti Studio project at Kingston University, which is working with Tony to teach young people the art of record production and to revive the practices of the past that are specific for those large format studios, which is an art that's kind of at risk of being extinct soon. Yeah.
Tony's studio as such, it's his kind of like his teaching hospital.
That's a good way to put it. And we invite him in to just make records there, and he also teaches the students, so he does lectures and he does talks, and he just also lets the students assist him when he's in there working and he's recorded some of his own projects there as well. So we sort of said to him, look, you know, if we put your name on the door, will you come and use it? And he's like, yeah. So sometimes he'll come and book sessions. Yeah, it's really cool. And it's really great for us as researchers and students to watch people work, because that's how knowledge was passed down in, you know, in the olden days. People learned by watching and being around creative practice. So
he really we're trying to recreate those conditions. Of that generation, isn't he, Tony? He's really one of the great elder statesmen of record production.
Yeah, and he's also really vital to London recording culture. So he was like part of the whole scene in the 70s and had his own studio in Dean Street, you know, throughout the 80s. Even though he's from New York, he's actually, I would say, kind of more legendary here in London as part of the recording culture here. And so he's a big piece of the puzzle, along with, you know, the other legends, Glyn Johns and Chris Kimsey and all these people from the big facilities. And a lot of them are still kicking around, you know, and it's important that we capture those stories and capture that practice and document it somehow. And that's what we're doing at Visconti Studio. So we invite other people in too. We've had Peter Walsh, who's the producer that's quite associated with Scott Walker, sort of did all his work from 1985 onwards. He came in February to record.
You did a Scott Walker Day, didn't you, last year?
We did.
Yes.
It was. So we're doing a lot of this sort of work, not just, you know, scratching my Bowie fan itch, just doing things that I like to do. But we are sort of, we've also got Chris Kimsey, who's sort of, you know, the famous engineer and producer from Olympic. He's worked a lot with the Stones. So we're working with him as well. So it's very exciting. I think it's important work. You know, I can't wait for COVID-19 to be over and we can go back to the studio, because that's where I like to be.
What's wrong with you?
I know, I'm crazy, aren't I? Yeah. I want to get back to work. But that's really important to me. And so I'm really proud of it. And I think Tony's proud of it as well. He's always bringing people to the studio and expanding my network as a result. So it's really good.
I understand you were the spark that really got this going.
Yeah, kind of. I just got the job at Kingston and I saw this amazing space, this huge 300 square meter octagon that was set up to be a studio once and it had sort of not been used. And so I started asking the questions, and then one thing led to another. We decided to make it analog. So we decided to put tape machines and vintage gear in there. Yeah, I went to New York a couple of times to do some work with NYU and visited Tony and mentioned it, and it sort of rolled on from there. And he got attached to it. And I think we caught him at that right point in his career where he's keen to give back. And so it was just, I don't know, kismet. Just happened.
That's
very
lovely.
Good.
Donnie, the studios that you guys did Black Star in New York, was that Tony's go-to studio or was that your go-to studio?
It wasn't my go-to studio. I had been there once or twice, like a decade before, before this. So I knew about it, but it wasn't really a place I went regularly. I think it was Tony's suggestion. Thinking back right now, I think he'd recommended it from what I remember, and it was great. You know, it was the setup, it was intimate. We're all sort of in, you know, there was a sax booth, and at the head of the sax booth was where David was standing with a microphone, and, you know, I was looking at his profile, and he had, you know, a guitar at times, and Mark Giuliano, the drummer, was on my right, and Jason just to the left of him, and Tim just to the left of him. That's usually the way that we play, prior to this whole experience. You know, we were used to playing in intimate settings, and even when we're playing, even if we happen to be at a festival where there's a bigger stage, we try to play kind of tight, because I think a lot of what happens between us is the interaction, you know, and that sense of sort of passing the ball from musician to musician, and a lot of playing off each other and taking somebody's idea and expounding upon it, and then somebody else doing something and then going in another direction. You know, there's a lot of that adjusting on the fly. And I just find sometimes that physically setting up closer actually makes a difference. And it's just come through experience. Like, there's been many times where I've been on stages and, you know, the band sets up far away, the sound isn't great, and then, you know, the gig is a struggle. So I couldn't hear enough of this, or my monitor mix wasn't right. And so just over the years, you know, just started taking the approach of let's just be, you know, as tight as we can be. And I find that it helps. So it was that atmosphere in the studio, which was great. And I think that was really positive.
You know, this really contributed to the feel of the record. So that was something quite fundamental. I was really keen to find out from you about your literal physical surroundings and how that contributed to your interactions.
Yeah. And, you know, and one thing that comes to mind when talking about it is that David was essentially in the live room with Tim, Jason, and Mark. And so Mark's drum set was totally bleeding into David's microphone, and it really had that intimacy sonically. And it brings to mind Sewer in the Season. No, wait, what song I'm thinking of here? Sorry, Tis a Pity She Was a Whore. But there's a moment on that, I remember it clearly, that David kind of lets out this a whoop, you know, like woo,
yes.
You know, and that
that's when you take the solo, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot, I guess so. But we were just like in a frenzy, you know, and I don't know ultimately how much of the final vocal on that particular track was live versus overdubbed, but I know that moment was certainly live. And the energy was just so palpable for all of us, and it was so intense. And his demonstrative, you know, yell there, it really captured that moment, because we all heard it, and we were just feeling it when we were playing. And that intimacy was there, and it was tremendous.
You know, the magic shop is shut now. Just going back to the bugbear of these studios closing down and not surviving. But that studio is shut now, and it's a real shame. You know, there was a vintage Neve desk in there, a special shape, right? This corner desk, all that stuff being sold, you know. I mean, in 50 years' time, people will be still talking about Black Star, still talking about what we're talking about today, about how it was made and what makes it such a special piece of music. And you won't be able to go back to that site or, you know, go back to that equipment and see it. And I just think it's such a shame.
Leah, I could tell you a little bit about the equipment. The studio did close. It wasn't that long after we did the recording. It might have been 6 months or 8 months, roughly. I remember reading about it in the New York Times. And I think what was happening was the co-op that owned that space, they raised the rent on the studio owner just an unbelievable amount. So anyway, he did sell the studio. So he sold the Neve console to a guy who I met who lives outside of Iowa City in Iowa. And I forget the guy's name, but he had all the whole board, and I think some of the other gear as well, shipped out there. And he built a barn on his property to house it. And he got the board, like he went in and I think did some maintenance, you know, on the board, and I don't know if he personally did it or he brought some people in to do it, but you know, he's the kind of guy who has so much respect for the history of the board and for the magic shop. And so he built this barn on his property. It's just outside Iowa City. I think it's called the Magic Barn, actually.
Magic Barn.
Yeah, if you want to look it up, I wonder, he might even have like a Facebook page. I bet he does, actually. So I was out there on tour, and the guy who booked the gig, you know, told me the story, and they took me out there. So I went out, and they were actually doing their first day of recording, and they were doing a version of Heroes, you know, to honor David. And it was great. It was great to see that a guy who had so much love and respect for the history of it, you know, and he's trying to do right by it. And this was like 3-4 years ago now. So I don't know. I haven't followed up with him. I haven't seen him since that night, but it felt like it was in good hands. You know, again, it was in the hands of somebody who really wanted to do right by it and continue the legacy in his own way.
Thank you for telling me that. That is just so lovely. Like, that just warms my heart. A piece of the magic shop still lives on, and someone cared enough to give it the respect of you know, keeping it serviced, keeping it operational. That's so cool. Love that story. Thank you.
It is really nice to hear a story like that where there is such a wonderful ending. To go back to the beginning, there's this wonderful story about how Bowie came into a club in Manhattan to see you one night.
Maria Schneider, I've been in her group, maybe 15 years or something, and She called me one day and said that somebody from Bowie's team had reached out to her, that he was interested in collaborating with her. And she was getting ready to make her own record called the Thompson Fields. And Maria is somebody who, you know, goes in deep when she's doing her own project. I mean, it's a total immersive experience on her end, you know, just for months or a year or something. So I think essentially at the beginning, kind of debating whether or not to take on this thing with David, because she would also, she never does anything without being fully committed to it. And so we, you know, she ran it by me and I remember essentially saying, hey, you ought to do this, you know, be a good idea. And also knowing that her music was in really good shape for the record we've been playing and whatnot. So yeah. So then I guess we talked again. She'd been in contact with David and was starting to kind of put the pieces together, and they had started meeting. And I think he was going to her apartment and sitting at her piano, which is in the living room, and they were working on Sue. So, you know, then she called me one point and we were discussing, you know, well, I recommended Mark Giuliana, you know, because I thought he would be great for this. And I don't think her normal drummer, Clarence Penn, could make it. Then she was, you know, just talking with me about different ideas around it. And then another day she called and said, hey, you know, David was describing the rhythmic underpinning, what he was hearing on Sue, and I thought of you, and I played him a record of yours, and it was a record called Casting for Gravity. And I told him that he should do something with you and your band, you know. So I said, thank you. You know, I mean, you know, I was pretty surprised, and obviously, you know, it was really meaningful that she would do that, you know. And some more time went by, and then she called again and said that she recommended, you know, again to David, and that he was interested in, he had told her that he saw that we were playing at the 55 Bar, which is this club. And so, you know, she said, okay, we're going to come down and check you out. So,
so she told you in advance that they were coming.
She told me in advance and
no pressure.
The component, yeah, no pressure indeed. The component I'm leaving out is that, you know, some of these calls were around setting up the workshops for Sue, the Sue version that I'm a part of, because I'm in Maria's band. And she was, you know, she wanted to put together just a few people from the band, myself, Mark, Jay Anderson on bass, Ryan Keverly on trombone, and to start workshopping this piece. So that was about a week after this gig at the 55 Bar. I know that they're coming. It happens to be like the last rehearsal before, live gig before we're going to record some music of mine. So, you know, all the stuff going on. I think I told Mark about it because he knew, because he was going to be on the thing with Maria, but I didn't tell the other guys. They came. The 55 Bar is this very, very small place in the West Village that I love and love and love. I've played so much music there. I've learned so much there. And they were there, and I didn't, you know, I think I saw him out of the corner of my eye, but it's, as you can imagine, it's something you don't want to focus on. You know, I just want to focus on the music and being present, being in the moment, not thinking about what could happen or this or that, because I just, you know, just didn't feel like it would serve me well. So I just tried to stay in the moment. And then, you know, we finished the set and people came up and they were gone. So I didn't meet them or anything. And it wasn't until a week later when I went to the first workshop for Sue where I met David. And that was David and Tony Visconti and Coco Schwab, David's assistant, was there, and Maria, as I mentioned, Mark, Jay, and Ryan, and myself.
What did you know of Bowie beforehand, and were you kind of familiar with his music? Did you, I mean, obviously you knew where he was in the pantheon of rock and roll and so on. How much of a big deal was this for you?
I mean, I would say I had a general knowledge of his music. I mean, the record Let's Dance was one that I loved, and that was part of my senior year in high school. And, you know, the three main songs from that record, I just loved. And so, you know, that was a record I had listened to the most, I would say. And then of course there was the collaboration with Pat Metheny, you know, and I was aware of that because I, you know, coming from the jazz thing. Yeah. And then I would say after that, it's just, I had a general awareness of the hits, you know, Rebel, Excuse, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But if at that point you would have said to me, oh, what do you think about the Berlin Trilogy? I would not have known what you were talking about.
Right.
You know, I wouldn't have known. And what I would say, I guess it was a certain point where David had sent me the music, had sent me about four or five songs, and we were initially going to record in the fall. And just to give you a bit of the timeline, the gig we're talking about at the 55 Bar was like June or something, or late June or something. And then the
2014,
I think so.
2014, yeah.
Yeah. And then the Maria rehearsal, you know, was a week later. Then there was another Maria rehearsal where we added Ben and Wander on guitar a couple of weeks after that. And then that recording of Sue with Maria and David is like July. But just to give you the timeline, so we were initially going to start recording Black Star in the fall, right? And then it got postponed. So I had these four or five songs. I was checking them out. And at a certain point, I thought, okay, let me really check out his catalog, so I can put this in the context of everything that came before. And you know, I started doing it. And at a certain point, I think I started thinking, you know what? I'm not sure if this is the right move, because this is the right time for this, because he wants me and my group to kind of do what we do. And if I go too far into his discography, I think I might be too influenced by it, if that makes sense. And then I had an email exchange with him about it, actually. And the spirit of that exchange was like, hey, you know, I'm loving it. I'm starting to check out some of your other stuff. And you know, what he wrote back was like, essentially saying, you know, I'm into some different stuff now. That was then. And I'm in a different headspace right now, kind of thing. And it kind of affirmed my gut, which was like, yeah, don't go. This isn't the time to go too deep down that path. Just kind of keep plowing ahead with processing the music that he was sending through my own musical language or whatever. Just let it, you know, kind of wash over me, bring it as far in as I can, and just move forward with it. So that's what I did. And then after the fact, I went back and I've done, you know, a really deep dive into his discography, and it's been tremendous.
Hey, I've been checking out your back catalog. Okay, don't do that.
Yeah, that was essentially what, you know, kind of what he said.
One of the things that you are doing is you're doing a book about Bowie between 2013 and 2016. And I was just kind of curious, could you maybe give us some background? You know, how was he navigating his way out of The Next Day and towards Black Star?
Well, I mean, the thing is, we don't know. You know, all we have of David Bowie's story is the stuff that he made. You know, we've just got the products, we've got the records, we have the Maria Schneider version of Sue, then we have the Tis a Pity She's a Whore demo, and then it's all very tantalizing, very different, very diverse. I mean, I'm not trying to make excuses. I'm not writing a biography, so I'm not really interested in, you know, finding out sort of what he was doing, what he was eating for breakfast. But certainly, like, it feels to me like there's a reawakening of some creative energy. You know, there's a desire to just sort of mess stuff up. If you listen to all of the weird sounds that are on The Next Day, it still sounds quite cohesive because the band is there and because it took a long time of multi-tracking, you know, it took a long time to pull it together. Whereas, you know, the really quick succession of the work that happened after is all quite confident in its execution. It's all quite characterful, you know, and I love that demo for Tis a Pity She's a Whore. It's just whacked. It's so amazing. And, you know, and then of course, Black Star feels like the climax of that, this like energy, this pure liveness, this kind of, you know, this feeling of elation and catharsis. And so I really think that he was just having a quickening. I think he was just finding a flow and letting himself be dragged along by it. And I think it's really exciting. It's what makes this period really exciting to listen to. He was trusting his gut too. So he was sort of, you know, seeing people around him and going, yes, I want to work with you. I want to work with you. Let's do this. Let's change that. And so I feel like, you know, Donnie and his band are just at the right place at the right time and, you know, offered an opportunity for him to do this thing that he was excited about. And it all just came together. And I can't say for sure what was going through his mind, but just looking at the work, it just feels like he feels very excited. You can feel it coming from the work, you know?
Yeah, if I could just add to that, you know, I didn't have a long relationship with him, but my sense was he was in a very fertile period creatively. And one thing that was happening was we would record Black Star from, let's say, you know, 11 a.m. would be the start. We'd get there a little bit before, but we start recording at 11 and then we maybe finish at 4 And my understanding is that on some of those days, David was then going and meeting with Henry Hay, who was the musical director of Lazarus. Yeah. Ironically, Henry's like an old friend of mine. I don't even know he was doing, you know, I didn't know that Henry was working on Lazarus. I didn't know David was working with Henry. And so we're like,
you had no idea that was all going on.
It's all going on at the same time.
Wow.
So, he's working with us doing that. And then he goes, and then my sense is that at home, he's listening to what we've recorded the day before. And some of the lyrics are evolving and he's writing more music.
He's making demos, right? Because he's like sending you stuff, sending you ideas for arrangements and things.
Yeah. Well, essentially it was like I had these 5-ish tunes before the first week of recording. Leah, we had about a month break. And at some point during that month, I got another 5 or 6 tunes, and then we had another, let's say, a month break. And then about 2 days before, the final thing, there was another, 4-ish tunes. So he was writing. But the other sense I had was that he was somebody who was really able to process a lot of information. He just read a lot, a lot of literature and listened to music and was able to really like process it quickly. Because there's a lot of musicians that I know that are, it's like you listen to like one record or like 2 tracks off one record and you're just all in on all these details, it's maybe a harder thing to like process 2 records or 3 records. And anyway, I just had a sense that he was just really able in an extraordinary way to process all this information. And just a final thing was so after it was finished, there was these months where they were working on the mixing and the post-production and all that. And then Black Star, comes out and I guess November or something, it was the first time I heard it. But, then we're in conversation then and he was talking about, I'm writing new music. I want to record again. The last time I spoke to him, that was a big part of the conversation was, we're going to record again in January as soon as I'm feeling better, right. Like that kind of thing. So he was really, to me, that's a lot of creative output.
He was on a roll, wasn't he? Something that Donnie just said about this sort of demoing stage where he'd send you these demos and then you go to the studio. Am I right in assuming that the first batch were the Lazarus songs and then Tis a Pity and the ones that he had already, like Sue, were they the ones that he sent first?
Yeah. Let me just think about this, Leah. It was definitely Lazarus, definitely Sue, and definitely Tis a Pity. And there was one that we recorded various times that didn't end up, that came out on No Plan. I think it's called No Plan.
Yeah, it would have been from the musical, right?
Exactly. So that was one of the first tunes. I'm 98% on that one. When I Met You, that was in the first batch. And then the one that's Killing a Little Time.
Yeah.
That was in the first batch. Yeah, I think and I'm confirming that No Plan. It had a different title at the time, but yeah, that was there as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I'm thinking now because these aren't album tracks really, except for Sue and Tis a Pity, which he already had. So the rest of the album tracks must have, been after this first recording session, after this first flush of, being in the room with you guys and hearing you and working with you. It seems like he then finished, the bigger songs from Black Star, like, the 10-minute epic and, Dollar Days and things like that, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think Black Star was,
It's almost like, fruits of your relationship, these really, really big songs, they're coming towards the end of this time that you've had together.
Thank you. But yes, Black Star and I Can't Give Everything Away came in the last group of tunes. And Dollar Days wasn't one that we had a demo on. It was I was talking about it the other day with Arslan. We just sort of finished, the tunes that had been planned, and it was midday and there was an acoustic guitar in the studio and he just picked it up. And it was like the first time he picked it up, as far as I remember, and just started playing this thing. And it just sort of happened, where he's playing this riff and we're just kind of listening. And then eventually in maybe 10 minutes, we go to the piano and Jason is at the piano with him. And then, you know, we're all out in the room listening, and then, you know, Tim's playing, you know, it's just kind of happening. And then I think I remember at one point we're talking about the saxophone solo, and I think I had said, how about we, you know, modulate to this or, you know, key or whatever, made a little suggestion. And then we just started recording it, and we didn't, as was the case with almost everything on Black Star, we didn't do, you know, 10, 15 takes. It was like one, two or three takes and that was it. So with Dollar Days, it was actually pretty quick. From the time you picked up the guitar to when we were done tracking, I'm going to guess was about 2 hours.
From start to finish.
From start to finish. And in a way it was so quick that I had forgotten about it. And when I think I did the first interview about Black Star, and I guess maybe I hadn't heard the record yet, they were asking me about the song, and I was like, man, I have no idea what you're talking about.
There's a song called Dollar Days? Really?
That was kind of part of the brilliance, or just, you know, when I heard the record for the first time, it was like, wow. You know what? And because he had... I mean, on that tune, he didn't have all the lyrics worked out, of course. So he was,
right.
I don't remember exactly what it was on that tune, but there was, you know, he was kind of, he had the melodies, the vocal melodies, you know, that are the sketches of that in place, but not all the lyrical content was there yet. So hearing that from that moment and then hearing it in its final formation was pretty stunning, I have to say.
I can imagine that on guitar, actually, thinking about those chords. They're very like Bowie strumming on a 12-string sort of chords. When on the piano, they just sort of take on a different personality. But wow, to hear it was composed and arranged in such a short amount of time. I mean, again, that just speaks to the relationship that you guys had and that it was growing as you were working together. It wasn't just, you know, you were session men, just came in and did the job and you're out. You know, it was like this thing that was cultivated, which I think is really special. And I think you can hear it, actually, in the progression of the songs and their quality.
The analogy that I use is, it's, you know, I was describing earlier that the way that we all play off each other prior to this experience, there's a lot of, it's very, you know, the conversational, a lot of improvising, a lot of just changing the direction of the music on somebody's suggestion. So real intentional listening to everybody in the group, you know, and everybody trying to have this feeling like we can just take on different roles at any moment and so on and so forth. And I think one of the things that was really so beautiful about this was that, you know, David had these really strong songs, this framework that he brought, and then he was in there and he was absolutely participating in that dynamic that I'm describing to you. He stepped right in, and, you know, it just upped the ante and upped the experience for all of us. Cause he was such a dynamic, you know, performer and, you know, just a dynamic presence. And we felt it when we were recording, and it felt magical. I would, you know, finish the day in the studio and be going home and was thinking, man, that was a great day. And I, you know, I hope that tomorrow is like that. I hope every day is like that. And I think for the most part, every day was, we felt that connection was happening in the room. You know, there were some days where it's like, you know, there's 30 alto flute overdubs, you know, it's not Sue, you know, every day, but it was, that's one of the big takeaways for me about what a remarkable experience it was it's all these elements coming together, the way we play together, him stepping right into it and enhancing it and bringing, you know, these, in my opinion, really tremendous songs.
Leah, is there a comparable group dynamic, do you think, at some point in Bowie's career that echoes what Donny's talking about here? Because this sounds like such a magical experience where Bowie's love of improvisation, his deep knowledge and appreciation of jazz, his willingness to turn quickly, use an accident, came to the fore.
Well, I mean, traditionally there's this idea that Bowie's always had these great legendary musicians, these sidemen, you know, you've got your Mike Garsons and your Mick Ronsons and all the way along your Reeve Gabrels, you know, as you go.
But they're individuals.
They're individuals, but they do have that great funk core band in the 70s with Dennis Davis and, you know, all of those guys.
True, yes.
That went right from like 77 through to 1980. Just really, really good band. But I wanted to bring this back to the idea that, you know, I was really grateful, actually, when I was reading all of the stuff that came out. You know, Donnie, you were like very quick to say that the arrangements and the demos were really strong, that the ideas were there. You were sort of really quick to dispel this idea that you sort of swanned in and made Bowie sound good. And there was this sort of idea that, you know, Bowie left all this space and you just filled it with your jazz and it sounds great. And that's why it's a great record. And I think sometimes people criticize Bowie for that because, you know, he sort of adopts styles and aesthetics quite easily. And then these people that he's partnered with, they represent that aesthetic. And so people tend to default then and say, oh, the industrial stuff with Reeves was because that's what he liked to do. And the funk stuff he did with Niles, because that's what Niles likes to do. And I really appreciated, Donnie, when you sort of said, no, these songs were great. Like they were there, they were demos. He'd written them, you know, we worked on them together and he was involved in that. He didn't just give them to us and said, right, make that sound good. It was, let's work on this together. Let's build it up in collaboration. I think when you look back at the catalog, you know, that's, I can kind of tell, you know, when he's in a situation like that, when he's surrounded by people who are with him on the same page and everyone's just trying to be creative and do something great. And I think that you can really sense that on Black Star, but also you can sense that in the Berlin work as well. And you can sense that a little bit in the 90s with the band that he put together there, you know, when he was touring in 95. You can feel that there too. This kind of everybody just pulling in the same direction, just making cool sounds. So I feel like that chemistry, you can sense it as a listener as well. But it must be amazing to sense it as a player. I mean, goddamn, that must be great.
It was really something special, you know, remarkable. To me, in a way, it was a transformative experience, you know, on various levels, you know, and it was, it was amazing, really.
And that was me, Leah Cardos, and Donnie McCaslin speaking from Georgia in the United States via the magic of Zoom. And a huge thanks to all of them for participating. A big thanks to David Bowie Glamour magazine for connecting us. And thanks to you for listening. I really appreciate it. I really hope you've enjoyed it. And we're going to be back with the next installment very soon, where we will start with the actual title track itself and work from there. So stay tuned, and please do share this episode, like it, all those nice things. It's really appreciated, as ever. I really, really am grateful for likes and for comments and all that sort of thing. It makes it all worthwhile. Thank you, guys.